Let's go back to the egg head. By the way, there's an interesting movie out, The White Countess, and the main female figure is Sophia.
Ooh, all the White Countess.
Yeah. That new Keystone Arts.
Okay.
Yeah, fashionable. And they try to exclude her. It's very interesting if you look at it archetypally.
You mean Sophia is a real person?
The antagonist, the female antagonist, is Sophia.
Oh.
She's named Sophia. I don't want to tell you too much because I'll ruin the story. But it starts out real slow. I almost walked out. Yeah, I think, oh, I can't believe I paid whatever it is to see this stupid movie. But wait, hang in there. It picks up. After about an hour.
Everybody says that, and I thought too, and I have the same feeling, that I'm just kind of caught in the cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the dynamic of that? I think there's got to be something interesting, because that's sort of an across-the-board experience.
That must be intentional, yeah.
I don't know what is, but...
Because that guy made Howard's End, right?
Yeah.
And that got you from the very beginning, so he does know how to make a movie.
Yeah, but so I just wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
So many people have said it's not really slow, but it's there, and it's true. But
how easy it is to step off the wall being
conscious. Or maybe how Sophia comes on in very mundane ways.
Drives you almost to leave.
But we're worth the wait.
But worth the wait, there you go.
And the little girl, is that... That was Vanessa Redgrave's daughter, is that? Her granddaughter?
Actually, the woman who played Sophia is Vanessa Redgrave's daughter.
Oh, that's her daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, Amanda.
Miranda.
Yeah. And she's married to a woman.
Oh, is she really?
Mm-hmm.
And that little girl is no blood relative of... she was good, too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Liam Neeson's first acting role was in Excalibur.
Oh, my gosh.
I think I have to contribute something.
Thank you. Feminine.
I want a diagram
there. Speaking of diagrams, I brought along the egg with the Ouroboros in the center and the red and the white rose. That's what they're referring to. I'll pass that around.
You've shown that before.
Have I shown that before? Let's go back and just look at one more meaning of the head. As I said, basically I thought that the head was... just on the simplest level, his necessity to, admonition for him to stay true to his own process. And then we just looked at the different archetypal aspects of that. One, that in alchemy it represents objectivity over against storm of emotion. And we talked about it also as the separation of a new point of view out of the past. And the last point that he brings in is that in alchemy, the head and the egg are used interchangeably for images of the prima materia. One of this is not directly related, but it's just a little background. One of the clearest, I think one of the most beautiful images in classical mythology is that Eros is born from an egg, which is incubated by night, if you think about that. And then Eros goes and creates the world. And that's what he was saying. The spirit of Eros... Which can be found in the freed from the darkness.
Incubated by the night.
By night, yeah. I think it shows the relationship between despair and love.
And then Eros goes out.
And I'm pretty sure that's right. I'll double check on that. But then Eros creates the world. And Eros is born first from an egg. Yeah, Orphic version.
Oh, God, thank you. That is really interesting.
But I'll check to be... I've got it basically right.
Okay.
I'll check to be sure. I know, and I'm pretty sure night incubates the egg, and then Eros is born from the egg.
It's so pertinent why I'm doing it. Okay.
what is the significance of the knight being gone?
Sorry?
What is the significance of the knight being involved?
Well, it's out of despair that real love is born, I think. People who have a capacity to love also have a capacity for despair. You would think they're opposites, but they're not. And if you can bear your despair until it turns, that's how you increase your capacity for intimacy. Which in a way applies to Paul, because that's what he couldn't do. He couldn't bear his despair. Now, why he brings it in, it really... I think it shows, you know, that the head also represents the problem of opposites. But he also uses it as kind of a springboard to come back to this dialogue between Kepler and Flood. And referring to a Greek alchemical text, just to establish his point, he says there on page 32, the first paragraph down, in a way this is what Carol was also illustrating. The egg is a dragon biting its own tail, which is full of dots, stars, whose order corresponds to that of the celestial stars. It exists before the four elements, and it is the most universal, the mediator, the divine, the egg, the immutable, infinite, and at the same time, finite origin.
Now, you said that the head... What did you say?
The head and the egg are used interchangeably to represent the same thing.
The prima materia.
Prima materia.
And so is the tail symbolism, the Ouroboros.
Well, pretty soon everything becomes everything. This is one of the problems. But in a sense, you're right. And in a sense, I think it in your picture, the Ouroboros is implied in the cosmos down below, and it's also implied in the circulation. So if you can tolerate this everything is everything stuff for a minute, let's see if we can at least bring some order into it. What Kepler and Flood did is they grabbed hold of this image of the Ouroboros, and I think who started it, Kepler, Flood, I think, said that Kepler, remember they were in controversy about the nature of their worldview, so that their personal conflict was a conflict over really two eons of worldview. And Flood said of Kepler that he only holds the tail of the Ouroboros. And he says, this is quoting Flood, the next quote there on page 32, but here lies the whole difficulty, because Kepler excogitates the exterior movements of the created thing, whereas I contemplate the internal and essential impulses that issue from nature herself. He has hold of the tail, I grasp the head, I perceive the first cause, he its effects. I think I might have said that backwards. Flood felt he had the head, and he's saying Kepler only has the tail. Now, just put a pause here for a second. Why is that important? Psychologically for Pali, because he is going to have to go back, and he's being asked to go back and examine these two dimensions of reality, the head and the tail, as applies to physics and applies to his own life. So it just gives us another metaphor for expressing what we've already been expressing, that the Ouroboros is a whole. And what science has done, science has simply concerned itself with the tail, with the visible manifestations of movement in our world. But the medievalists saw that there was another dimension to reality, and that is the soul that was animating that. That has been cast out from the scientific worldview because it is quantitatively meaningless. What do you do with that? Nothing. But we're looking at this period of history as this conflict in this period of history as really still expressing two sides of the nature of reality, and we've got to go back now and try to reconstruct that in a way that is consistent with our modern methodology. That's why this is so important. What got lost? What got lost was the head of the Ouroboros at this time. Because what remained was only the quantitative, and the head would represent the soul, which the medievalists and the ancients thought was moving this stuff. The reason stuff moved, because there was something in it moving it.
Is that why they did so many beheadings years ago?
I don't know. It's an interesting thought. Why that was the...
It was usually someone that was antagonistic to what the collective thinking was.
Yeah. As if to say, get that head off. Yeah. I don't know the history of that. And I guess it was actually gruesome. Sometimes those things didn't cut it off. They had to get an axe and chop it off.
Post them on the end of the pike or something in the city square to let people know that they can't use walls. So.
We saw an excellent French movie in our French class last semester about, I forget what it was called, The Widow of St. Pierre, where it was about a murder in a French island, which actually was part of France, off of Newfoundland. It's a teensy little island. And I think around the turn of the century, last century, there was a murder, and they convicted the guy, but they didn't have a guillotine. It was such a small island. So I will also make a French movie about it, let's have the French about having to execute a guy, and they have no guillotine. And actually, so we read the real story, and that in that case, the guillotine came down, and the head didn't get chopped off. I mean, it's pretty crazy. And I guess now, I mean, it's been outlawed. They don't do that. We are like one of two countries that execute people. Isn't that interesting? And my French teacher said, don't you think it's strange that America is a Christian nation and one of the few that executes people? How do you explain that? That's what I love hearing. I don't think they do. But officially, China and America are the two leaders of capital punishment. Very, very sobering thought. Anyway, okay. To which Kepler responded, I reflect on the visible movements determinable by the senses themselves. You may consider the inner impulses and endeavor to distinguish them according to grades. I hold the tail, but I hold it in my hand. You may grasp the head mentally, though only I fear in your dreams. So you see, it's this inner impulses that we're forced to come back to reconsider. And if we recognize now, mind you, I'm not trying to suggest we should accept this literally, but as a metaphor, if we accept that there are such a thing as inner impulses in matter, that leaves life open to be a mystery. But if you accept that the movement of objects is to be only understood by their regularity, then you cast out any possibility of mystery. So another way to say this is it's an attempt to go back and see how has science cast out the mystery and how can we pull it back in. That could be another way of looking at that head, that the head as egg represents this problem of the relationship between the quantitative and qualitative understanding of life, which Pali was being asked to consider and stay true to. As we go along, it gets a little bit more subjective or a little less easy to demonstrate, but these are possible levels of meaning. But I think the easiest thing is to say, true, untrue, that's what the dream was about.
Question at the bottom of page.
32, I'm just not reading the last sentence of the last, next to the last, well, not the last line, but the one above it where it says, and Kepler didn't let go of the tail, and the flood may have grasped the head, but Kepler saw that the Rosicrucian thereby ran the risk of losing himself in a dream world. I didn't understand. Saw that the Rosicrucian...
A flood was a Rosicrucian.
Okay, saw that the Rosicrucian...
thereby ran the risk.
Okay, saw that the Rosicrucian. I thought the Rosicrucian was going to... That's like a noun. I just didn't understand.
Yeah, for a Rosicrucian, just substitute flood. Kepler saw that flood thereby ran the risk of losing himself in a dream.
Okay, thank you. Got it.
I think I even put a footnote there that should be explained.
Okay.
Maybe just let's look at the very last couple of sentences on page 33. The content of the unconscious symbolized by the head is unknown to Pali. Indeed, the unconscious will soon send him images which intend a completely different physics. That's the key phrase. And the one he's currently teaching at the ETH. A physics which pays attention to the soul connection and which expresses the secret of the cosmos, not in mathematical formula, but rather seeks it deep within the human bond. Well, I kind of figured that this is our assignment.
Ah.
I mean, it's my assignment anyway. Again, what I've said, but just to put it in this context, that I think we're seeing the evolution of a new worldview just in its seed form here. We don't know what this is going to look like, but these are the questions that need to be answered. And we'll watch. And we'll try to piece together as best we can an understanding of how that may look through these little intimations throughout the various streams about what this new worldview may look like. So the dreams now are going to start giving us piece by piece by piece, perhaps new bricks in the future edifice of a next paradigm. It's going to be pretty inadequate, but... I do think, you know, and well, Jung thought it was a 500-year task.
So this idea of the circulation of light, which I think seems to penetrate into, is that also the way you understand the mandala?
Yeah.
Circulation of light. In what way?
Well, the circulation of light, remember, is from the Secret of the Golden Flower. And it was... it was the description given to what the meditating person should do was to circulate the light in themselves, and as they circulated the light in themselves, the golden flower would be born. Now Jung interpreted that metaphorically, that the circulation of the light would represent our directing our consciousness to all the nooks and crannies in our own personality that we don't know again and again until we begin to be able to take responsibility for them, hear what they want, and so on. And what he also felt was as you do that, as consciousness does that, there's a reaction from the unconscious in that it begins to generate images of the mandala. And what the mandala represents is your own stability and solidity and integrity. So that we don't create those things, solidity, integrity, reliability and so on, but we create the possibility of the unconscious creating them by our paying attention to ourselves. So the circulation of the light is really the act of consciousness. It's mandala-like in that it goes around again and again and again and again.
I do really, so you might have mentioned that in my introducing you all to me, that I had been to this psychosynthesis intensive. And we actually did do exercise along those lines of seeing, experiencing the light shining down on the different personality type, which they emphasize a lot. Understanding your personality, being integrated. So I can relate to that.
Yeah, I think they have very much the same idea as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, they drew from you.
Well, that gets us through page 33. Questions?
So this circulation of light is a conscious effort.
That would be the effort of consciousness.
So that must be why the painting's motif is air. Because air is the symbol of thought, thinking.
Right.
Could you say that?
I think you could say that. Or cogitation might be a better word.
So the goal of creating yoga and meditation, too.
It is. Of course, we take that differently, but that's certainly, I think, what they're aiming at. We're taking that as a metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They try to comprehend it.
Well, I hate to judge other traditions. Let's just say, I'd say Jung takes all the stuff as a metaphor for individuation. Other questions? 36. Blonde and the Persian. Remember we talked about these two figures as being two dimensions of the same thing? Does that all sound familiar? And so we're going to be examining them, and we're going to see them pretty soon coalesce into a single figure. Now, the reason I mentioned what I did in the last chapter, when I said I thought Pauli's comments on the dream were just kind of silly, that's what I think this next dream talks about. In March 1947, we find in Pauli's inner world a further motif that concerns not only the classical mechanics of Kepler, Galileo, and Newton, but also pertains to modern physics, and I think we could also then say it also pertains to himself personally. The motif of uncommitted thinking. That's the phrase.
Uncommitted. So you're saying that's what the last dream talked about, uncommitted?
No, I'm saying that what we saw in Pauli's comments to the dream is an example of uncommitted thinking.
And that's the inability to address the issue.
And the words actually are a nice smokescreen for really feeling and responding to what the dream images say. I mean, for example, I think we'll get to this later. If not, I'll bring the quote along where he marches into Anila Yaffe's one afternoon and just starts insulting her. And then she said, get out. And that was the end of that relationship. They had a friendship. Now, to have... Let's suppose you have that tendency to start fights and hurt people and blame them and walk out of the room and end the relationship. It's not that untypical of personal style. But... what if he had taken that previous dream seriously, he would have realized he woke up in a bad mood and he was going to go see Fra Yaffe for tea or whatever it was, and here it comes again. here's my behavior pattern. I am about to destroy one more friendship. I better stop and cancel that engagement and go talk to somebody about that before I do it. That would be a committed relationship to that previous dream. He would have caught himself, here I go again, I'm being untrue to this friendship rather than being true to this friendship. And this is the kind of behavior that I was being warned about in that previous dream. But no, he comes across some grand, this is some archetypal content coming. So what? That's true, but it's irrelevant. The thing that the dream was trying to get him to see, I would say, is how he violated the trust of friends. That's the committed dimension that I think this dream is talking about, and we saw evidence in his intellectual grasp of the previous dream. Does that make sense to everybody? Very big difference.
Because I would say
uncommitted
feeling, but that helps explain
it. Yeah, and it's because he came up with these, we'll see, he came up with these theoretical interpretations of his dreams, like he was teaching them to a class at a training institute. This is the archetypal aspect of the dream. End of discussion. And you see, we've talked all along about his feeling problem. That's the way a person with a feeling problem works with dreams. They don't feel the implications of what is being told to them. And he's going to do that again and again and again and again.
Is that because he's not in touch with
him? Well, it's the word because that I'm hesitating on. It's certainly an indication of not being in touch with his feeling. Now, remember in the Inquisition dream, the animal wasn't there at the beginning. And then at the end, he's crying. That would be what he should have done when he insulted Valiafe. And that would have been the beginning of his own growth. Maybe he could have blown up at her, then come back and apologized. You know, here I go again, I'm sorry, can we start over? That level of experience, the grief over the harm that's done, is what's missing. And another way to say that is the anima would be the experience of the grief you're causing to people you care about. Or the ability to experience the grief to the people you care about. And believe me, this is not to be taken as self-evident. If you just listen to relationships, people are hurting each other's feelings all the time and saying, tough. So in that sense, we're seeing a bit of ourselves in Pali.
Yeah, because I think that tendency to scapegoat is another form of inflation.
That's, yeah. And another form of denial of emotion. You project where you should feel something, and you're unable to feel it. I mean, that's one of the ways. You with me on this? How I'm just trying to make this a little practical, and also to give us a way to examine our own selves. You know, have I done that? Who have I hurt? Whose feelings have I denied? Or has somebody done that to me and I accepted it? It's rampant. So the dream. There are two young men present. I take them for Americans and know that they are physicists. I'm very embarrassed because I don't know their names and they appear to expect me to do so. I address both of them with made-up names that don't appear to be correct. Now, one of the two men leaves. The other, however, remains and says in a rebuking way, always this uncommitted archetypal thinking which the physics books are full of. It doesn't get much clearer than that. Now, the author here takes it in one way, which I can accept. I think I had to add another dimension to it. He basically says that the nature of physics is that you think uncommittedly. That the research done in science is objective, and the researcher has no personal feeling. That's basically what he says. He thinks the dream means. But I think it's more Pauli's just blowing hot air. It really doesn't have all that much to do with his relationship to physics as it has to do with his relationship to his feeling function.
But in one way, it does relate to this whole way of science, that is that
it's true.
That you do experiments and you make conclusions, but you with the idea that if somebody has proved that they're wrong, then you're supposed to be in a psychological state of being able to say, oh, well, I'm wrong, and you say you go on to the next step.
And
so in that way, you're not ever totally committed.
Right.
In that sense.
And I think also that you don't have to be committed to the ethical implications of your work. It's done for a corporation.
Remember? I think about even in university also.
Any institution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I
think the deeper level is that it is what we understand by the word knowledge. That all knowledge is a good thing. And science is in the pursuit of knowledge. And that is apart from the personality of the researcher. Now, we're going to see Pauli kind of understands this, and I mentioned it earlier just to come back to it. We'll come back to it yet again. He also realized that while he was working on his theories, he had dreams of mythological images, and that underneath the theory was an image. Remember, we talked about that. Does that sound familiar? So that there was a way for the scientists to begin to feel what he was doing. So we'll pursue this a little more.
One other thing I'm going to point out.
Yeah.
I'm also reading an interesting book like other people read. It's called The God Particle by Letterman.
Oh, I have that book, actually.
I'm shocked that it is as good as it is.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that he really goes through is this history of science. I'm amazed that he took the time to do that, you know, being a leader in particle physics. But I see why, because he's trying to come up with some new ideas about particle physics, and he's trying to retravel that whole path, and he does it in detail. But one of the things he makes is that the kind of leading principle is in science is that when you don't do it the way we're talking about, you know, where you're not totally committed to the end result, then you're not fruitful. Research is not fruitful, and that it turns into religion, basically. And that's how that uncommitted kind of thing gets propagated, because only in that way did science gain the fruitfulness that it had, you know, in the limited sense that we know now, you know, in the technological kind of aspect of it.
I hear you. I'm not sure I agree with it.
No, I'm just saying, I know we're more into a bigger understanding now, but that's what is promoting the scientific attitude, that if you don't take that position, or the kind of uncommitted kind of way, then it turns into religion and you don't really have the fruitful research. I mean, in terms of technological advancement.
Because here's the guy.
I'm just saying that this is something that is a roadblock that is deeply entrenched.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say that they're committed to the process, but they're not committed to the outcome?
Right, right. Yeah. In other words, they're saying that before they're really starting with. Kepler, there was efforts, but it didn't really go anywhere in terms of science.
Right.
And the reason was that he didn't have this principle of experimentation, conclusions.
Right.
And then if somebody else comes up with better, a different, it proved you wrong, then you must be prepared to say, okay, I was wrong. So I'm just thinking that whole process sets up that kind of uncommitted kind of attitude, which I agree with you, we got to go beyond. But I understand it's kind of it's in the thick of the scientific process.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Well, I think that word uncommitted, the way you're using it here, is indiscriminating. At least that's the way you explained it. Did I not hear you right? And it's uncommitted in the sense that it's not committed to life, to the truth, to helping things, but it's really more indiscriminate because he's unable to discriminate between what will give life and what will destroy it.
That's certainly true. It does not contain the ability to discriminate between what will give life and what will destroy it, definitely.
But
there's another dimension to it. I don't know quite how to put it. He doesn't feel personally responsible for what he's created.
And I'm saying that attitude fits in with the need to be able to give it up when somebody proves you wrong. You see what I mean? If you didn't have that attitude, you would stick to something regardless of whether somebody proves you wrong or not. You see what I mean? And that whole scientific ideology is that you've got to give it up.
Well, or maybe you've got to be prepared to suffer for your work. To commit to it and to allow yourself to be corrected and to grieve over that. We'll come back to this. We'll be seeing this several times. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I thought that he was so upset when the bomb went off because he had been a part of it.
Right.
Well, a part of him was committed.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the beauty. I've been kind of hard on him. There'll be times that I'll be critical of him, and there'll be times when I really admire him.
Okay.
That is his beauty. And he was I don't think it's fair to say. Certainly, Oppenheimer got very, very upset and tried to stop work on the nuclear weapons, hydrogen. Which is fusion, which is fission? I can never remember. Hydrogen is... it doesn't matter. Anyway, one was a lot...
Next generation.
He tried to stop work on the next generation of bombs. That's the beauty of Pelle, and that is why he's having these dreams, because he is upset.
Okay.
But the tragedy is he didn't have the courage to follow through on his own pain or on the upset of his own anima. Because it's his anima that's upset. That's the feminine that's upset. Right. So... his openness and really the amount of individuality he did achieve is why we even have these dreams in the first place. But then he stumbled in the face of their difficulty. Number two, I think you're probably all familiar with, right? We don't have to go into that stuff. So we go on to the next street, bottom of 36. I'm alone with a blonde woman. She leads me into a dark room, and I think to myself, I know what goes on here. But in the dark room, she says to me, get a pen. I want to dictate an essay to you. I wake up completely confused. Imagine what that would shock a guy. A young, dark man... his shadow is present and proffers conventional views in a friendly way. I don't remember any details. I answer him angrily, calling him a swindler and telling him to leave. Now he disappears and I meet two men. One of them says to me that he knows a singer, and this person has explained to him an essay which a woman had dictated to me in which she had given him the singer. Christ with a black and white striped nose appears and is very humble. Through this, my understanding of the sacrum, or the sacred, is to be completely changed. I am to wait a while.
And all these dreams are on the same night.
Same night. Yeah, that's actually, if you're curious, it's May 1947, not March.
So there aren't four fragments here. There are two of these go together?
There's two dreams. Well, it should be, there's a little typo. It should be I and double I. So the first dream is I am alone with a blonde woman. Mm-hmm. Second dream starts a dark young man.
Oh, and that whole thing is dream two.
And the whole thing is dream two.
Okay.
So I guess you figured out the first dream takes place in a brothel. What do you make of that?
His past can be communicated to the body as well.
Yeah, it's so weird that his sexuality is actually being affected by his creative work. And he feels it as a sexual urge, but beneath that is a creative urge. And his creative work is one of the ways for him to begin to transform his sexuality. Now, the next one is a biggie, I think, because we're going to see this striped nose business again. Obviously, you can figure out the proffering conventional views. That's the shadow, right? That's Herr Professor Kahlo. These dreams are amazingly clear. Then one of them says to me he knows a singer. Why a singer? What's that have to do with the essay?
Yeah.
Feeling, yeah. This is just what I was talking about. He begins to feel what's coming to him. How about the nose? Christ.
The what?
The nose. The striped nose.
Kind of sniff out things.
Right. What is he to sniff out?
Discrimination.
Certainly. But I think even bigger.
The sacred?
A new image of God.
Okay.
That is what is ultimately behind all of this stuff. Our image of God has is perpetrating this false understanding of the nature of reality. And as he understands matter differently, and as he understands the inner impulse, so to speak, to use that earlier image, in matter and in his own life, he's going to develop a new concept of God.
Is there something on the seventh, this different being in the know?
Yep. Intuition has to do with what time frame? Future. Intuitives are good at sniffing out where things are going. Stockbrokers, for example, the good ones, are all intuitives. They just sense it. So Pauli's work, he's being told, is for the future.
So the nose is indicative of an intuitive nature?
Yeah. Nose technically is interpreted as intuition. Because we say, you know, oh, I sniffed that out.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's told then is his understanding of the sacrum will be changed. So I take that to mean that, again, this is I've told you some of my conclusions already, and now we're looking at why I said some of these things, that his work is really in the service of a new worldview. That's the nose. And not just the material world, but also our religion. And, you know, that, just what I said there is such an insult to the unconscious, because as far as it's concerned, there isn't a religion and a physics. There is a worldview. And part of our job is to see how those two things aren't separate. That's how this theme of God suddenly comes up when we've been talking about matter. So again, we have been studying a lot of this, some of us now, for years here. You know, matter and spirit, matter and psyche, and I've often we just looked at these ideas as finished conclusions. But now you're seeing why it is that Jung and von Franz have developed these ideas. It's from looking at dreams like this, where the nose and the material world, or the nose as future and the material world and the concept of God are all in one short dream. These things are not separate. So they therefore try to present this kind of view in their writing, that what we're working on is a worldview that will both transform our view of God and our view of matter, and that is the same transformation. And to do it one way or the other is to propagate the problem. And it's from looking at these kinds of dreams that they said that. Let me see. Where are we? We're just about out of time, for one thing. The other thing we didn't talk about is the black and white. And that would have to do with the oscillations. So if you look at oscillations from above, if you look at them from the side, they're like this. If you look at them from above, all you see is the periodic markings of that wave from above. So it's like looking down on that oscillation.
So you're saying that this experience also relates back to his problem of trying to understand how the mind and matter.
Yeah. Where first place we saw that was in his dream on time. That the other dimension here is he's got to begin to realize there are two different dimensions to time. And that's part of what he has to sniff out. And part of what this new worldview is going to include. So we got in this little simple dream many different strands converging. The time issue, the God issue, the matter issue, the sex issue, the feeling issue. All of these are different dimensions of the process of change that's trying to press itself in on him, and us, and science.
So was Paul pretty much working on his own almost? Well, I guess we'll see. That'd be difficult for him to process all of this.
Yeah. Well, he had von Franz, and he had Jung, and he had Jaffe.
Get to it,
but he pissed them off one by one. Yeah, if you can't do them with him. I mean, I think, you know, I hope we can maintain a balanced view of this man, the value of what he did accomplish, the times in which he lived, not particularly supportive to this sort of inner journey, still not very supportive to this kind of inner journey. That's his strength and the courage to undertake it when he could have just retired to Florida. He could have taken a post at Princeton for probably the equivalent today of about $500,000 a year and put his feet up and never taught a class. But he went back into the fray. So that's the positive side of the guy. The downside is, I think, we have to see where he failed. And not hopefully not to run him down, but to see now what problems are left to us.
That was, I guess, the other side of it, was that, as he pointed out, that Young actually purposely tried not to get too close to his
family. Well, that was before this.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so that with the idea that he didn't want to contaminate his dream. So maybe we might not, there's a possibility we might not have gotten as much if we... There have been closer words,
but now they're friends. When Pally came back, they picked up a friendship. So they would have dinner, write letters. A lot of this is from their letters. They probably get together, I don't know, every couple months, have a lunch or a beer. I know Pally would drink beer Friday afternoon with the guy who trained me every Friday afternoon. So he had plenty of resources around him. So again, if we can look at what he has done, look at what he hasn't done, not to be critical, to belittle him, but to see what tasks remain, then I think we'll let this really be his gift to us. So that takes us to roughly the middle of 37.